The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Good morning. You are listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. We have the Book Nook coming up for you. And today we're going to bring you a conversation with Greg Iles. His latest novel, Mississippi Blood, has just come out in paperback. And it was one of my favorite novels of last year. And just an amazing third book in his Natchez Burning trilogy. And I was able to record an interview with Greg when the book came out in hardcover, and we're going to bring you some excerpts from that right after National Public Radio News. Good morning. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. And last year, I had an opportunity to do my first interview with a writer named Greg Iles. Greg is from Mississippi. He was born in Stuttgart, Germany, where his father was a doctor at the U.S. Embassy Medical Clinic. But he grew up in Natchez, Mississippi, where he sets most of his novels. After attending Trinity Episcopal Day School, he graduated from the University of Mississippi in 1983. Then he began a music career. He spent several years as a guitarist, singer, and songwriter in the band Frankly Scarlet. He quit the band after he was married and began working on his first novel, Spandau Phoenix, a thriller about Nazi war criminal Rudolf Hess, which was published in 1993. He recently completed a trilogy called Natchez Burning, and it's just an amazing trilogy. The first book came out in 2014, the second book, The Bone Tree, in 2015, and the final book, Mississippi Blood, came out last year. Over 2,000 pages of amazing fiction, and the paperback of the third book, Mississippi Blood, just came out. Let's listen now to Greg Iles talking about Natchez Burning.
The way for people to think about this is at its core, even though it's epic in scale, and it really has to do with race and family and America and the South, what it's really about is a son discovering that the father who raised him, who was a beloved figure in the community, a physician, may not be the man that he and everyone else thought he was, and that he may have committed a serious crime, a murder to cover up a sin from his past. And that may sound a little bit gothic, and maybe it is, but at its core, that's what the story is.
Now, I understand you introduced your protagonist in some other books. Tell us about him.
Well, Penn Cage is a bit of a Grisham-esque character to start out. He's sort of a Boy Scout. He's a former prosecutor from Texas who turned his hand to writing legal thrillers, and his life was going pretty well till his wife got cancer and died. And he returned to his hometown and got caught up, became mayor of the town. And in the course of doing that, he began to take on, I would say, the negative parts of society or flat-out evil on a more direct basis. And, you know, he's, over the years, over the books, he's compromised with his ideals, and he's had to, you know, when we fight evil, as they say, we sometimes have to take on the tactics of our adversaries, and that can help you win, but it can also, you pay a moral price for that and a price in your soul. So that's the territory these books are in. That I want people to know, how many books do you start, and it's the same old formulaic thing, a new version of the last book? These books are not that. None of the Penn Cage books. These hit you where you live, and I think people know that a few pages in. So I hope they give them a chance, because you know how it is. It's hard to find good books these days. You know what my rule is? This: if a book is bad, it can't be short enough, and if a book is good, it can't be long enough. Think of Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry. I wish that book would have never ended.
My guess is Greg Iles. Greg, his father, Penn's father, is Dr. Tom Cage, and much loved in his community. And as we discover, a very conflicted character, very mysterious character. Now, I understand that your dad was also a doctor, and I know that Penn Cage isn't you, but there are some autobiographical elements in here, and I like to point to one in the first book, and I don't think it's a spoiler to say at one point Penn sees a photo, and he recognizes himself as a little boy, and he's at a Ku Klux Klan rally, and it's a huge rally, and this really happened, didn't it?
Yeah, that rally, that's the biggest KKK rally in the history of the United States, and it happened 1 mile from the little suburban house I grew up in. And my dad took me down there, not as a participant, but my dad was really educated. He was a reader, and he was a doctor, and he had served in Germany. So he knew what fascism was like, and he did not like that. And he took me far enough down there to see the spectacle, and he took pictures of it. And what I saw is just indelible in my mind. Not only the guys, the men and the women with robes and some children, but even the horses had these red robes on and white Klan robes. It was one of the scariest things you can imagine.
And this must have been in, what, the mid-60s?
That was 65. Yeah, at a place called Liberty Park, a place where I ended up practicing football as a 12-year-old and playing baseball. And, yeah, it's, you know, that's the thing. These things are interwoven in the fabric of the town. And it's misleading. You know, the thing, when you write about something like this, it sort of fulfills a northern fantasy that race is a southern problem. And if the events of the last 3 years or so have proved anything, it's that race is an American problem. You know, these police shootings and the riots and these problems, they're not happening in Selma, Alabama, or Natchez, Mississippi. They're happening in very different places geographically. The thing about race in the South is, racism was always in the open in the South. It's covert in the North and in the West.
Greg, when I was looking into this series and you, I discovered that from what I'm hearing, this Natchez Burning was going to be a standalone book. And then when you got going on the project, something really changed it. And this was a life-changing event for you, wasn't it? You nearly died.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was near my deadline, and I was trying to write it as a conventional thriller, albeit a long one. And I pulled out onto Highway 61, which everybody knows from the Dylan song, of course, and a pickup truck hit my driver's door going 70 miles an hour, broke many, many bones, like my bandmate Stephen King in his accident, but also it tore my aorta, which about 1% of people, I think, survived that. And I woke up out of a coma a week later. And I just, at that point, my entire perspective had changed. You know, I thought, I'm writing about the South. I'm writing about race. I'm writing about family. I'm not going to pull any punches, and I'm not going to worry about the commercial demands. And so suddenly the book expanded to, I realized it was going to take 3 epic novels to deal with it. And in the course of that, I had to change agents. I lost my publisher. It was really a challenging road for me with a lot of uncertainty. But ultimately, when Natchez Burning came out 5 years later, my previous book had been number one. Then 5 years passed, and nobody knew if this thing would sell at all. So it's really been sort of a miracle for me.
I guess we need to talk about the Double Eagles. Tell us about them. Are they a real group? Did they really exist?
Well, the real group is called the Silver Dollar Group. And my character, Henry Sexton, the heroic reporter, is based on a guy named Stanley Nelson, who I've come to know really well, a reporter at a tiny little newspaper across the river from me, 5,000 subscribers. And he was only beat out for the Pulitzer Prize by the Spotlight team on the church story. And Stanley, I don't want to say too much, but thankfully, this is a guy who's worked in obscurity for little to no money his whole life, and he outdid the FBI on these real-life civil rights cold cases. And finally, Hollywood is coming knocking, wanting to make a movie about Stanley. So that's a great thing. Now, the group themselves, the Silver Dollar Group, who I call the Double Eagles, were a group of disillusioned Klan guys who knew the KKK had been penetrated by the FBI. They stopped They stopped going to meetings. They pretended they weren't in the Klan. The only badge of membership they carried was a silver dollar minted in the year of their birth. And these were some psychotic, racist guys that did a lot of damage. They killed a lot of people. You don't even want to talk about what their crimes were. And that's the only thing that led me to write about the KKK. You know, as a thriller writer from the South, I had never written about the KKK because it falls into that sort of northern dark stereotype of what the South is. And if you know much about the Klan, you know that they were compromised pretty early on by the FBI. Some of the heads of the Klan were paid informants by the Bureau. But these double eagles or silver dollar guys, these were some bad guys, and none of them ever went to jail until really one just a few years ago. So this had to be addressed.
Another element in this is the fact that these double eagles, at least the core original group, these guys were war veterans, and they'd been very desensitized to violence. They actually savored it, and this bled through literally into their activities after leaving the service.
Well, you know, there's a contradiction. When we think of wartime heroes, we automatically put our John Wayne glasses on, and we just see them as 100%. Boy Scouts grown up to being Sergeant Rock, but anybody from the military can tell you a guy can be heroic under combat conditions and God forbid can be convicted for child molestation 5 years later when he gets home. I mean, human beings are human beings and they are complex and nobody is true blue through and through and nobody is truly evil through and through. But men like that who are very accustomed to violence. For them, violence is just it's like saying war is an extension of politics by other means. On a personal level, for men who were very accustomed to killing, once they found themselves in what they saw as a race war or a war for the preservation of the white race, it was only natural for them to use violence. That was the tool they knew. They didn't have any qualms about it. It's similar to when you start looking at the JFK assassination. People tend to look at that as this big mythic thing they studied about in school, the assassination of the president. When in fact, if you look at it as a simple murder, cui bono, who stood to benefit, who would be willing to cross a line like that? For men accustomed to violence, whether it's Cuban revolutionaries or mafioso who took out hits every couple of weeks, violence is not a big deal. And killing a president was not necessarily a big deal.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. You're listening to The Book Nook, and I'm Vic McCunis, and today I'm bringing you some excerpts from an interview I recorded last year with Greg Iles when the third and final book in his Natchez Burning trilogy was released. It was called Mississippi Blood, and he came through our area. And we're going to continue with that interview right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO, bringing you an interview with Greg Iles today. And Greg wrote the third book in his trilogy, and it's called Mississippi Blood. It came out last year, and the book just came out in paperback. And we're bringing you some excerpts from the interview I recorded with him last year from Mississippi Blood. This is an amazing trilogy, over 2,000 pages of just crazy fiction, amazing stuff. I highly recommend it. It was one of my favorite books last year. Let's listen now to the second segment of my interview with Greg Iles on The Book Nook.
Penn loses somebody very dear to him in the second book. Yeah. And, you know, Penn is not your traditional thriller hero. He's cerebral. He's more, in some ways, he's more of an observer, more than he's not a fake, all physical action hero. And he sort of needs a partner. And Serenity came late. She is an African American writer who's become famous for writing a memoir, but she's a military veteran. And I just was on a radio show here in Jackson, Mississippi. And the producer was an African-American woman who looked like a slight little thing. And the host told me she was an Army veteran. So I thought, you know what? Serenity's pretty close to some real-life figures, I found out.
I think
she sort of provides. Here's the irony: to come to a thriller like this, if you want to call it a thriller, and the physical stuff is not being done by the male hero; it's being done by the female writer. You know, I think that's part of the twist, and it's a lot of the fun of it. Mm-hmm. Even though it's a pretty heavy subject, but still, it has some fun and some humor in it.
Penn is not Jack Reacher.
No, he's not.
No,
he's not. And that's no knock against Jack Reacher, but these are different kind of books than that.
My guest is Greg Iles. And Greg, I think we need to talk about, is it Viola?
Viola, yeah.
Okay, I think we need to talk about her a little bit.
Viola is, Viola Turner is the African-American nurse of Dr. Tom Cage back in the 60s. And she is somebody who was certainly smart enough to have been a physician, but due to the exigencies of life, wound up being a nurse. And not even one with a nursing degree, but just trained in the hospital, as a lot of women were back in those days. In Natchez, they trained them in Charity Hospital. And they worked their whole lives, very dedicated. But through working in close proximity to Dr. Cage through stressful times, and after losing her husband in Vietnam War, as so many young African-American guys died over there, she ends up in an affair with Dr. Cage in the traumatic 60s. And a child results from that, unknown to the doctor. We're getting up close to spoiler territory.
Mm-hmm.
But because of that and because of the activism of her brother in the movement, she has to flee to Chicago, and she only lives because she promises never to return. And, of course, she does return after many years. She returns to die in her hometown, as a lot of people do. I'm finding in as I age, you know, a lot of African-Americans returning to Mississippi, white folks too. You know, they go off and make their living, and then they retire back home. And that's what kicks off the story, really. You know, was she, when she dies at the opening of the first book, was it a mercy killing? Did Tom Cage do her the favor of her life? Did he kill her to silence her? Or was she killed by the KKK, who threatened to kill her if she ever came back? And boy, that's just the starting point. So I think people can tell how complex a story this is. You got to realize these crimes were kept secret sort of by the conspiracy of propriety in southern towns. You know, it just, they didn't write in the paper about these murders. Or if they did, it was just a cursory mention. You know, if it was very high profile, while they might mention there was a reward offered by a national union or something, but you didn't hear about this stuff. And these guys had real jobs. They were cops, or they worked at the paper mill or the tire plant, and normal life went on. And yet, once it was dark, once midnight passed, these guys were doing some seriously psychopathic stuff and hurting a lot of people.
We become almost sympathetic with this double eagle who is essentially on his deathbed and wants to talk to the editor.
Yeah.
He wants to somehow get these crimes off of his conscience. And when you do his death scene, oh,
ooh.
I love that death scene. I think my favorite part, though, is when he starts talking about his credit card, but we won't talk about that.
Oh, my God. You know, to me, the coldest thing about that was the role the sister
His sister,
had in it,
yeah.
You know.
Uh-huh.
That just, when you think that something like that deep tribal racist feeling could even overpower ties of family, man, that's a pretty scary thing.
Yeah.
And you see it play out right in front of your eyes. It's disturbing.
Well, and even though he has been involved in all these evil acts, we feel sympathy for him.
You get the feeling he was the big kid, the fat kid, the slow kid, and that somehow these things he did, he was sort of bullied into it. And you know, what could he have done? Obviously, he could have gone to the police, but my God, the police were infiltrated with Klan too. But you got to ask yourself, it's a moral conundrum. You know, is the guy who takes part in the gang rape on the pool table because he's scared to, his friends are going to make fun of him, is he less guilty than the other guys who committed the crime? I mean, this is, you know, difficult stuff.
He's a really complex character, Dr. Tom Cage, and we don't really know what's going to happen with him. You keep this story going with him. I thought in the first book that he was going to drop dead with a cigar in his mouth, and you just
yeah. Well, you know, that in a way that'd be a fitting ending, die in the saddle like that. But you know, and I had no intent to sort of leave anything open ended in this. But when I got to the end of the trial and realized what that needed to be, and I think if I say so myself, I think the present ending, you know, what you're trying for as a writer, you can't think about the fact that you have unlimited options, because it can make you a little crazy. But what you want to arrive at is the ending that once you've written it seems inevitable, and that it never could have been anything else. And I hope I've come to that ending. And that ending did leave, you're right, the door open for the very end of Tom's story. Now, I will not write that next, but maybe one or two books out, that will be the last one with this universe.
Well, this is quite an expedition going through these books, and as you mentioned, it would be fine, I suppose, to start with the third one, but I'm inclined to go back now and read all your stuff, Greg.
Well, I hope you do. And, you know, I tend to skip genres, and I move around a lot. I'm one of the few writers who's gotten to pursue whatever I'm most interested in at the time. You know, a lot of writers end up having to sort of rewrite the last book each time, and I've never done that. And so I won't say, you know, I'm not one of those guys who say you'll love every book I've done, because I've done so many different things. But I think maybe 8 times out of 10, I think you'll be glad you opened the cover.
Greg, I have time for just one more question.
Sure.
What's the best thing that ever happened to you?
Oh, my God. You know better than ask a question like that.
Oh, you can't say it on the radio, huh?
Well, you couldn't even pick something like that.
No, she's sitting right there, right?
Yeah, well, you know, kids too.
Okay.
But as relates to writing, I'll say this, and that is when you realize you're actually going to be able to make a living writing books. That is, you realize what a privilege that is. You grow up your life finding new universes, new worlds in books, and you revere the writers that you read and love, and to get to do that for a living, you almost don't have a boss, and it's just, it's lucky. You feel lucky.
Greg, thanks for everything.
Thank you, Vic. I had a good time, man.
And that was Greg Iles talking about his third book in his Natchez Burning trilogy. It just came out in paperback. It's called Mississippi Blood. And during our conversation, I talked to him about a terrible traffic accident that he had 7 years ago. He slightly downplayed the extent of his injuries. It's a miracle that he survived. He was seriously injured in a traffic accident on U.S. Route 61 near Natchez. He sustained life-threatening injuries, including a ruptured aorta. As he mentioned in the interview, 99% of the people who suffer that injury do not survive it. Plus, he was put into an induced coma for 8 days and lost his right leg below the knee. During his 3-year recovery, he wrote the Natchez Burning trilogy. And as he mentioned during our conversation, he hadn't planned to write 3 books. He was just going to write one, and everything changed after he was hurt and had time to recuperate and think about it. He also alluded to his musical career. He is a member of the literary musical group The Rock Bottom Remainders, which includes or has included the authors Dave Barry, Ridley Pearson, Stephen King, Scott Turow, Amy Tan, Mitch Albom, Roy Blount Jr., Matt Groening, and James McBride. And I'm happy to say we've had quite a number of those authors in the Book Nook. We'll continue with a special Best of the Book Nook bonus right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, and we have some extra time this morning. And I'm going to bring you an excerpt from an interview I recorded 17 years ago with an author who was really at the apogee of his literary career at the time. His name was Vince Flynn. The first time I interviewed Vince was back in 1999, and he was just getting started. By the time he returned in 2001 to talk to me about his 4th book, he was on top of the world. This book entered the New York Times top 10 bestseller list, and he had quite a career, which was tragically cut short 5 years ago when he died at the age of 47. At the time I tried to book this interview, he had already become such a hot item that when I contacted his publicist, she said, "No, I'm sorry, he's not available." But when he heard that I was interested in interviewing him because he was coming through the area, he changed his schedule because he had enjoyed our prior conversation and he wanted to come back. And he was booked solid. He was doing lots of talk radio on the AM dial, and he was very popular with a lot of conservative talk show hosts. Let's listen now to Vince Flynn, the late Vince Flynn, on the best of the Book Nook. Some music from the Middle East, from Palestine, get us in the mood for our guest in the Book Nook today. Vince Flynn returns to the program. His new book is called Separation of Power. How you doing, Vince?
Good. Tired, but happy to be here.
You know, you're really on a roll, Vince. I read this book and I said to myself, he's getting better and better and better. I can't put this darn thing down. Here it is, 3 o'clock in the morning. I've got to finish it.
Thank you. That's what I hope happens. I think the highest compliment you can give a person that writes commercial fiction, you know, political thrillers and such.
Now, has this been bizarre for you to be out with this book right now?
You know, I think like most people in America, I've settled down over the last 4 weeks. September 11th was exceptionally bizarre. It was a day that, you know, I'll never forget it, as most people won't who are sitting there watching it. But it was, for me, you know, someone who's been a student of terrorism for the last 10 years, it was something that I always thought was going to happen, but not in this route. You know, I thought that we'd start seeing some, and we can talk about this a little bit later because it was part of my fifth book. But I thought we'd start seeing some car bombs go off in the United States, and I thought eventually there'd be a chemical or biological or possibly nuclear attack. But I never in my wildest imagination, and I'm paid to think about this stuff, I never thought we'd see two planes hit those towers. And then even after they were hit, it didn't occur to me for the next 30 minutes that I never thought it possible that those things were going to come down the way they did. So yeah, it was a surreal day, and it's been kind of hard going on tour. But you know, you think to yourself, I don't have real problems standing in a security check line for an hour. You know, the people that lost their loved ones, you know, they're going through a lot more pain than we're suffering right now.
Did you ever imagine that the president would withhold information from key members of Congress?
Of course I did. Politicians tend to have a big mouth. You know, they like to talk, and it's not just them. You know, they tell their staffers what they've learned, and then their staffers, you know, have a girlfriend who works somewhere or a boyfriend who works somewhere, and the next thing you know, they're telling them, and the whispers and stuff gets leaked. It's, you know, Washington is not a town that's known for people of high integrity. That's just the reality of it, and that's what, you know, in my books, I kind of struck a chord with my first book, Term Limits, where the bad guys are the politicians. And the honorable people are the people who work for the FBI and the Secret Service and the CIA and the armed forces. And I've been continuing to build on that as the cynicism in this country has continued to grow. So I think, you know, I got kind of lucky that I came along at the right time for this.
Now, before we talk about the new book, Vince, I'd like to give our readers and listeners a little background on you. You've been on this program before. You've written a number of books now. You seem to be on a roll with this series. How does a guy go from being a bartender in the Twin Cities to being a best-selling author?
Well, it wasn't all that easy. First of all, after college, I went to work for Kraft General Foods, which ended up coming into play later when I self-published my book because you know, it was merchandising 101 when it came time to self-publish. And then from there, I went to work with a commercial real estate firm in the Twin Cities, leasing industrial and office space. And then I decided to quit at the age of 27, my day job, and chase this wild and crazy dream. And at the time, my rationale was no more complex than this. Tom Clancy was selling insurance, and he decided to write The Hunt for Red October. No one would publish that book. everybody in New York rejected it, and we all know what he went on to do. John Grisham, couldn't get a Time to Kill published to save his life. Robert Ludlum was doing voiceover work in New York, and he decided to start writing a novel. And so I thought, you know, if those guys can do it, why can't I? You know, I was just naive enough to think that I could go after it. And I thought I had a little bit of talent. If I worked hard enough, maybe it would happen. Well, 5 years later and 60-plus rejection letters, I finally decided to self-publish. And the book went to number one in the Twin Cities and in 3 weeks in August of 97. And a week later, I had a two-book deal with Pocket Books of Simon & Schuster, and kind of the rest is history.
I'll say.
But it wasn't easy, though.
And besides all that, you had a situation. I'm trying to think of somebody else. Stephen Cannell, I think, has been battling the same thing.
Yeah, dyslexia.
Yeah.
Yeah, Stephen is, I hope I get to meet him one of these times. We've crossed paths on the road before by just days. But I think, I don't know if it's the chicken before the egg or the cart before the horse or what it is. If dyslexic people tend to be creative, born that way, or do they become creative because they lose interest in school and they daydream and they start to exercise that muscle, if you will, and they start to cultivate the creative side of their brain because they just don't want to pay attention in school because it's no fun for them. So I don't know. But it's something that, you know, it's kind of strange growing up being horrified of something and then now making a living at it.
Well, he sat right there at least four times, and he keeps cranking out the books, and he knows how to write.
I've heard him interviewed. He's a fascinating guy.
He really is.
I love hearing him tell how Rockford Files got started. That's pretty cool.
Now, I'm a big fan of Rockford, so yeah, I've gotten into that with him a few times. Now, this new book, tell us about what led to this book. Now, obviously, you've got a character here who's been around.
Mitch Rapp.
Right.
Who debuted in Transfer of Power, which is my second book, and it's a story about the White House being taken over by Islamic fundamentalist terrorists who have seized the White House and almost got their hands on the president, who's now safely secured in his bunker, or so we think he's safely secured in his bunker underneath the White House. And then, of course, it's a big chase to, you know, get the president out before they get their hands on him, and they send Mitch Rapp in to do the job. And Rapp was a character that I found my motivation in trying to decide, okay, who's going to do a job like this? What type of an American would want to go to the Middle East and go deep undercover for a decade and assassinate people? And I thought this guy would have to be awfully motivated. So I fictionally created his character so that his girlfriend and love of his life and the woman that he hoped to marry died in the Pan Am Lockerbie plane crash. And that's how Mitch Rapp got started. And then after that tragedy, an elite group of senators in Washington went to the director of the CIA and said, we want you to take the war to the terrorists. And so Director Stansfield, the fictional character in the book, formed a group called the Orion Team, named after Orion, the god of hunters. And this group then went and started hunting terrorists down in the Middle East, which fortunately or unfortunately, is now a foreshadowing for the situation that I think we will be doing that stuff as a country. And we should have been doing it for a long time.
I've been listening to all the press conferences. We've been carrying them here on the station whenever they happen. Press Secretary Ari Fleischer, Colin Powell, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. And it never ceases to amaze me how many of these reporters ask really dumb questions like, who are you going to bomb tomorrow?
Oh, it just drives me nuts. I saw Peter Jennings the other day. It was on Sunday. He said, after the bombing stops, we're going to drop 35,000 tons of REMs. And then he, to back himself up, says, ready to eat meals. And I'm thinking to myself, no, that's Kraft macaroni and cheese. They're called MREs, meals ready to eat. That's what the military calls them. And I don't know of too many planes that could drop 35,000 tons of anything. they were going to drop 35,000 rations. And it just mystified me that this is a major news anchor who can't get that straight.
So they might have been dropping rapid eye movements or maybe
REM. Exactly. So we're gonna get a little REM in their blood.
I was up late last night finishing this book, and I love the ending. I love the middle. I love the beginning.
Thank you.
You're getting it together every time on these books.
Well, yeah, you know, we played a little trick on the readers last time with the third option, if you remember. It was a cliffhanger at the end. And, you know, when you run that risk, you upset some readers. There's no doubt about it. But my editor wanted me to do it. My agent wanted me to kill off a certain character at the end of that book, and my editor won out because she's got her eye on the long term, and her attitude is, listen, this leaving this book as a cliffhanger is only a problem until the next book comes out. And so now what we've seen is, you know, we've been blowing the third option out the door in paperback. It's been on the New York Times list for the last 5 weeks. And we put a sample chapter of Separation of Power in the paperback so that when people read that, they're done and they want to go right out and buy Separation of Power and find out, you know, what happens in the next book. And it's been fun. It's been fun hearing people's response, going into book signings and having people say, I read the third option last week. I went right out and bought Separation of Power, and I stayed up two nights in a row to finish it.
Well, it's definitely not Separation of Marketing. Wow. So the paperback just came out?
Paperback came out. They'd like to put the paperback out a month before the hardcover, so it gives people, you know, time to read that book and then go out and start buying the hardcover.
Okay. Well, I got the copy of Separation of Power, and I looked at the back at the photo, and I said, wow, they put a picture of Vince on here, or I should say of Mitch.
You know,
it's like, this guy's a bad dude.
Yeah, right. I got a lot of crap for that photo. You know, I have four brothers and two sisters.
You look really tough.
Yeah. I'm not tough at all.
No, you do. It's a beautiful photo. Is that your house?
No, that was an old house that I had, a writer's studio.
Okay.
Somewhere that I sold when I got married.
Is that in St. Paul? Is that an old photo?
Yeah, it's in the Twin Cities.
Okay.
It's a photo from a year and a half ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, let's talk about the new book. You know, when all this happened in the last month, the day it happened, the words Osama bin Laden were on a lot of people's lips. But I think other people were saying Saddam Hussein, Muammar Gaddafi.
Yeah.
These are all Middle Eastern bad guys. Saddam Hussein is your bad guy.
In the Separation of Power, Saddam Hussein's my bad guy. What happens is the book starts out, Mitch Rapp is trying to figure out, well, I should back up a sec. Director Stansfield, the head of the CIA, has died. And he and the president have picked Dr. Irene Kennedy as his successor, the head of the Counterterrorism Center. And Rapp is finding out that there's somebody in Washington doesn't want her to become the next director of Central Intelligence. So he is trying to figure that out. And in the meantime, the president knows that someone's trying to undermine his administration. And then the Israelis show up on the scene and drop in his lap a little nasty piece of information that they've just discovered that Saddam Hussein is a month away from going operational with three nuclear weapons. And the Israelis tell the president, if you don't take them out, we will. And the problem is compounded by the fact that the facility that Saddam has built is built under a hospital in downtown Baghdad. So if we bomb it, we're going to look like, you know, bloodthirsty maniacs. And that kind of sets the stage for what happens in Separation of Power. But back to your question, you know, about people thinking, was it Muammar Gaddafi? No. I knew it wasn't, and most of the people I don't. Muammar got a little gun-shy after Reagan sent in the F-111s and dropped the bombs on his home, and unfortunately one of his daughters was killed. You know, nobody wanted to see that. But he's really backed off the whole terrorism thing. He's learned it's not good for his country, it's not good for business, economically speaking, everything. So Muammar is no longer really, people don't consider him to be the threat that we once did. Saddam's a real problem. But because of what I've been reading and Al-Qaeda, and knowing about Al-Qaeda and talking to my people at the Central Intelligence Agency and the State Department, I had a pretty good inkling right away that it was Osama bin Laden. And in fact, in my fifth book, this is what's really strange for me right now. As a writer, you're supposed to be out in front of fact. You're supposed to be out ahead of the curve, trying to come up with new and interesting plots that'll motivate a reader to read a book. Well, on September 11th, fact just blew the doors right off of fiction, left us, you know, in their dust. The book that I was working on, that was going to be my fifth book, was titled Protect and Defend. And the book starts off with Osama bin Laden and some of the leaders of Hamas meeting with a former KGB colonel. And the KGB colonel tells them, listen, you're going about this the wrong way with Israel. If you want to get Israel to back off and give Palestine a free state, you have to take the battle to the Americans. You have to make the Americans buckle, and then they will get Israel to capitulate, because Israel will sit here all day and go blow for blow with you because they're tough. But the Americans, they don't want to see blood on their streets. So the book unfolded with car bombs going off in Washington, D.C. and New York City. And I can't write that book now.
Do you have any regrets you didn't flip-flop them and put that one out before this one?
No. I think that would be really tough to be on the road right now with a book like that. My book covers the issue of terrorism. I mean, that's what my books are about. Mitch Rapp is our counterterrorism specialist. But I just think that I'm hoping that in a year's time when my next book comes out, people will be healed enough that they can read something like that without getting offended or having their sensibilities offended. But I don't know. You know, I'm on the road here for the next month and a half, and my only objective during this tour is to try and figure out what I'm going to write next. Because I just, you know, I don't know. I think we're all kind of trying to figure out where everything's going to shake out right now.
When I called your publicist, they said, I'm sorry, he's already booked. And then 20 minutes later, they called back and they said, we're switching around his schedule so he can be there. And I thought that was great because...
Well, they called and I said, oh, no, I've done Vic's show before. Sign me up.
Well,
it's a good interview. I enjoy doing the show when I come through the area.
Well, I really appreciate that because... I would have regretted not having you come through. I'm wondering, as I read the book, I know you're not into gratuitous violence. I don't find that in your books, but you do use some violence because it's a violent world.
Yeah.
And I must say that the scene where Donatella goes back to her apartment, man, that's a good one.
Yeah, Donatella Ron we're getting really deep into the plot. I don't even know where to start with this one.
You don't have to tell anybody what
happened. She's Mitch's ex-girlfriend, and she's an Israeli assassin who works for Mossad. And somebody turns on her and tries to kill her, and she's one tough cookie. And before that little scene is over, there's bodies strewn about the apartment in every which way. And that is about as violent as I have ever gotten in a book. My wife read that, and she was like, you're kidding me. Because I actually used the name of two of her best friends. One of the Stacy Rosenthal, and it was, in the book it was so-and-so Rosenthal, and Donatella Ron is after a friend of hers, Angelina Ron. And so Stacy and Angelina are best friends, and in the scene, Donatella does something very bad to the Rosenthal character. And so my wife's friends are like, what are you doing? I said, well, you wanted to be in the book. I put you in there. Don't complain.
Vince was having a good time.
Yes, yes.
That's very funny. See, I never would have ever guessed that you were doing that with people's names.
Well, people always say to me, you know, can I be in your book? Can I be in your book? And I'm always looking for names. So I'll use someone's last name or first name, but never both together. And then I just run with it. And I don't, when I'm writing a scene, I don't think of these people. I don't really think of, I mean, I have a perfectly clear vision of what Mitch Rapp and Irene Kennedy look like. You know, I got that down. People always say to me, who do you see George Clooney playing Mitch Rapp, you know, or Tom Cruise or something? I'm like, no. You know, Hollywood can solve that if I'm ever lucky enough to have him buy a movie. But in my mind, this person's almost real. You know, I know exactly what they look like. So that way using friends' names doesn't get in the way, really.
Well, I'm a big accuracy freak, and when I read a book, I read so many books. when I find something that just doesn't jive, that just doesn't seem right, maybe an anachronism or something like that, I get all excited. Like, they made a mistake.
Yeah.
And reading your book, it rings so true. The sleazy senator, I think, is my favorite character.
Senator Clark?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know, he's one of my favorite characters, although I'd have to say the Congressman Rudin, I enjoyed probably writing more than anybody else because he's such a dyed-in-the-wool politician who's a reactionary man who has no control over his emotions. And he's basically the polar opposite of Senator Clark. And Clark just manipulates him throughout the whole book. And I would actually say that probably the most foreshadowing thing that I wrote in this most recent book is the fact that there are politicians on the Hill that have wanted to neuter the CIA for years. And in fact, they pretty much did it in the late 80s. Senator Torricelli is going to have to answer some questions here in the next couple months because he, in the late 80s, really went into the CIA and along with some of his colleagues and said, you know, you're done. No more covert ops. You're not going to be – we don't want you associating with some colonel down in Nicaragua who – we find out later, you know, tortured an American citizen. Well, that's a tragedy, but it would be like telling a cop, you know, we don't want you to go into this bad neighbor anymore and try to buy drugs from bad people. You know, cops have to get their hands dirty to get the job done, and the CIA has to get over there and mix with these people. And you know what? You're not going to go pay somebody who's an upstanding moral citizen $100,000 to find out what Osama bin Laden's up to. Because those people aren't, they're not mixing with Osama bin Laden.
Hmm. I think the biggest mystery in all of this in real life is where's Dick Cheney? Where's he hanging out?
You know, that's a good, my better question was where's Senator Moynihan been?
He retired.
I know that. I'm very well aware. And I'm a fan of Senator Moynihan. I think he's one of the only people in Washington who had the courage to try to confront what was wrong with Social Security. No one else would touch it. You know, it's the third rail of politics. And I still think Moynihan's a good guy, but he's a little misguided. He wanted the CIA basically shut down. You know, he lobbied to have their budget just basically reduced to nothing. And I'd like him to come out and start it. I think it's very disingenuous for politicians on the Hill to be blaming the CIA for what happened. The CIA is a reflection of the politicians on the Hill. That is what congressional oversight is all about. They control these bureaucracies. Sometimes it takes a few years for them to get them pointed in a different direction, but by and large, they control them. And it's just, I've talked to some people at Langley that are really offended. You know, they're saying, they did this to us, and now they're blaming us on it. But, and as to your Cheney question, I don't know how to answer that. I think that he is, you know, working behind the scenes, and I don't know if it's calculated to give Bush the spotlight, you know, so that people rally behind him. I'm not sure. He was awfully impressive on Meet the Press that first Sunday after the accident. The terrorist attack, the tragedy. But, yeah, you're right. I didn't even think of that. After that, I haven't seen him.
It's very mysterious. Well, Vince, I know you've got to run. I know you've got another interview coming right up, and just want to thank you for coming all this way out here to see us.
I appreciate you having me on the show. I always enjoy it.
You've been listening to a special bonus best of the Book Nook segment, my second, and it turned out final interview with Vince Flynn, the late Vince Flynn. That was recorded 17 years ago, and Vince was at the top of the literary world. His book was in the New York Times bestseller list in the top 10. I believe that one got up to number 7. And he was a very interesting guy. It was really fun to talk to him and to meet him. And just by happenstance, I did encounter him one other time. I was in Washington, D.C. at a big book conference they call Book Expo. And this would have been, probably about 2012, 2011, I don't remember the exact year. But he was there, and he was backstage. He was signing a big stack of books. He was back there with his agent, just the two of them. And a friend of mine took me back behind a curtain, and we saw just the two of them standing there in this big empty room.
And I walked up to Vince, and I said, Vince, you remember me? You came out to see me in Yellow Springs. We did a couple interviews out there. And he kind of gave me a blank look, like he really didn't remember me. But he was friendly. He chatted with me for a few moments, and it came as a big shock a couple years later when I heard that he had died. He announced in his fan newsletter on February 1st, 2011, that he was being treated for advanced stage 3 prostate cancer. And he died a couple of years later, so he was probably already sick when I saw him. He was an interesting guy, and his books were so successful that they are still coming out. They're still being written by another writer named Kyle Mills. The series lives on. And you know, when you've passed on to that great library in the sky and they're still putting out your books, that you were a popular writer. And Vince Flynn certainly was that. I hope you've enjoyed the Book Nook today, and I hope you'll go to our website at wyso.org and check out all the podcasts we have online. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.